Thank you. Welcome, everyone. The Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue, I will call to order. Just as a notification, we're in our last week of our session, so scheduling will be very, shall we say, flexible this week. So stay tuned. So let's start by calling the roll.
Senator Finley.
Flexibly here by video.
Senator Riley.
Senator Riley.
Excused.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner's present by video.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist on audio.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Burdick present by video. Chris, did you see Senator Riley earlier? I thought I saw him earlier.
I haven't seen him in the meeting.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we'll just start working our way through the agenda as it stands here. So Senate Bill, go ahead.
He just popped on the screen.
Okay. Please note for the record that Senator Riley, would you like to register your presence?
Yes, ma'am. I'm here.
By video. Okay, we will start by opening a work session on Senate Bill 864.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 864, you've heard on the 20th of May, June 14th, and today, 21st of June, which is, by the way, the first day of summer. And 94 degrees outside, thus my attire of the day to remind you of sine die. Senate Bill 864 comes to you with a dash 3 amendment. This is the bill that enables city or county to impose a tax on the sale of marijuana. And increases that threshold from what the current law of 3% is up to 10% in this new proposed bill. The dash 3 amendment also makes that new revenue that's coming from the 10% increase, if it's done by a city, that it would have a 20% of that revenue proceeds transferred to the county in which that city is in, providing that the county is eligible to receive that distribution. And also, in the cases of the cities that do exist within two counties, the deciding factor for the county would be where the retail establishment is. That's where the dash 3 amendment that you have, and you also, in your package, you would have the revenue impact statement, which primarily talks about the allowable or the allowing legislation or the permissive legislation as you have today. As we've discussed, and also you do have fiscal impact on that, which is a minimal. And that's back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We could use a motion, Senator Boquist.
Now, Madam Chair, I move the A3 amendment into SB 864, dated 6/14/21.
Senator Boquist has moved the dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 864. Is there discussion? Please call the roll.
Senator Finley.
Senator Finley votes aye.
Senator Riley.
Riley votes aye.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner votes aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist votes aye.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Burdick votes aye. Senator Boquist.
Madam Chair, I move SB 864 as amended by the A3 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist has moved Senate Bill 864 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Okay, please call the roll.
Senator Finley.
Senator Finley votes aye.
Senator Riley.
Riley votes aye.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner votes aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist votes aye.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Burdick votes aye. The measure passes. And Senator Finley and I will co-carry Senate Bill 864. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3295.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3295 comes to you from your federal committee on the House side, and the bill is attempting to fix an issue that came with the distribution formula for the counties. Now, as you're familiar, the money from marijuana point of sale tax is distributed in several percentages that are fixed, and 10% of that goes to counties, and a similar 10% goes to cities. The cities and counties have an established formula and law that allows for that distribution to be based primarily on the numbers of businesses in each of the jurisdiction. Now, the overarching requirement for any of the local governments to receive the distributions is that they also allow the existence and operation of marijuana businesses within their jurisdictions. And of course, since the establishment of these different distributions, it was always known as this is either all in or all out. So I think with time, there came an issue where certain counties would have allowed marijuana businesses to exist for a while, and then they opted out after a certain time. However, the existing businesses continue to exist at the time, which means that they still exist in the county, but the county, because of the all-in or all-out provision, no longer receives the distributions from the marijuana account. Now, what this bill attempts to resolve this is by making the process of distribution dependent on the grandfather in type of provision. So if the counties do still allow pre-existing businesses to operate within the county's jurisdiction, and if that prohibition or the opt-out, if you will, came between the year 2018 and 2021, then they need to establish an advisory panel to give the county commission advice and consultation on that process. And also for future processes, if that will occur in different counties, that advisory panel should also be established before that opt-out comes into action. So that primarily what would change in existing law. And accordingly, as you would see in the revenue impact statement, that this in general does not change the revenue as we have it, but primarily moves about $376,880 from the all county distributions, the total pot, and allow it to go to Deschutes County in this sense, because that's the county that actually would be qualifying under this new bill. So that's what you have. And just to mention that that number is almost fixed because of Measure 110. The one thing that Measure 110 did is made the distributions to city and county is fixed. All the distributions are fixed at $90 million per biennium, which means going forward, only $90 million per biennium will go to all the distributions. $90 million per biennium for all the distributions means 10% of that goes to counties, which is about $9 million from now on, and it will not change. Any increase in marijuana revenue would go to the new fund that was established by Measure 110, which is the Addiction Fund. And that's the bill. Back to you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. We have Representative Kropp signed up on this. Welcome, Representative Kropp.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and Vice Chair Boquist and members of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. My name is Jason Kropp, State Representative for House District 54, which encompasses most of Bend. I'll start off by saying sort of what this bill doesn't do. This bill doesn't impact Measure 110. This bill doesn't impact the distribution formula under the Oregon marijuana account. This bill clarifies a piece that in regards to the 10% of the Oregon marijuana account that is distributed to counties. So at the origins of our legalization of cannabis in the state, there were sort of two foundational pieces. One, each local government would be able to make a decision about whether they were going to participate or not participate in the cannabis economy. And those governments and communities that participated in the cannabis economy would receive a share of revenue to deal with issues related to this unique industry. And so at the beginning, there was this phrase, you're either going to be an opt-in county or you're going to be an opt-out county. And an opt-in county would mean that a county that allowed for production and processing licenses, that also allowed for wholesale and retail licenses. And if you were an opt-in county, you would receive a share of revenue. That revenue formula for counties makes a lot of sense. Half of the county's revenue depends on how many square feet of production you have relative to the rest of the state. So the more you produce, the larger your share of revenue. And the other half of that revenue for counties is based on total number of wholesale, retail, and processing licenses within the county. So the more licenses, the larger your share of revenue. So for example, Jackson and Josephine County are our largest production counties, and Multnomah County has our largest number of licenses, and those are the three top counties for marijuana revenue. What has this bill aims to clarify is something that did not seem to be anticipated, and that is when an opt-in county places a cap on a new type of licenses. And that's what happened recently in my county of Deschutes County. Deschutes County placed a cap on new production and processing licenses. Now, Deschutes County has wholesale and retail licenses, and those businesses will continue, and new licenses can be added in those two categories. Deschutes County also has production and processing licenses, and those businesses will continue, but there is currently a cap on new types of licenses of that type. Under our current laws, 475B.759 of the ORS, the Department of Revenue's interpretation of that statute is that Deschutes County is no longer eligible for an allotment of revenue. So this interpretation has resulted in a situation where Deschutes County is ninth in production in the state and the seventh largest number of licenses in the state, but is not eligible for a share of revenue. This bill seeks to clarify that. So this bill states that if a county is a full participant in the cannabis economy, and by full participant meaning do you have wholesale, retail, production and processing licenses, then that county will be eligible for a share of revenue in relation to how much it participates in the cannabis economy. The original draft, that was sort of the original draft of this bill, and I had multiple conversations with people involved in the cannabis businesses that raised concerns about what had happened in Deschutes County and what would be the potential, maybe unintended consequences of this bill. And an amendment, we drafted an amendment based on those conversations, and the goal would be to create a space for structured conversations with a variety of stakeholders. Now, this bill requires, if a county is considering a cap, before it can place a cap, it has to convene what is called a cannabis advisory committee. So this is modeled after a successful advisory committee in Jackson County. And that would require a variety of stakeholders coming together, including marijuana license holders, member of the public, county officials, and law enforcement to meet and make recommendations to the county, make recommendations on the use of marijuana revenue by the county, issues related to production and sale of marijuana in the county, and also issues of public safety related to marijuana use and marijuana entities. And I will say that section resonates with me. In my previous career, I was a Deschutes County Deputy District Attorney when I worked in both our juvenile justice system and our criminal justice system. I worked on multiple cases involving young people struggling with addiction issues. And I also prosecuted people for theft and criminal mischief and destruction of marijuana businesses in my community. So I think that's important that we have structured conversations for them. In sum, this bill seeks to remedy the situation that has happened in Deschutes County, which is this. We have a county that is a full participant in the cannabis economy. We have a county that is generating revenue for the rest of the state, but is not receiving an allocation of revenue to address issues that crop up with this industry. So that's the brief overview. I'm happy to take any questions that the committee might have after other testimony or now as well.
Okay, are there any questions for Representative Kropp? Okay, I see no questions. Thank you. So now we'll move to Michael Hughes. If you'll introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Michael Hughes. I'm an attorney down in Bend, Oregon. I've worked intimately with many cannabis and hemp businesses down here in the county, dealing with our county. Deschutes County early on decided that they were going to take a very restrictive approach to allowing licenses in their county. They created the most restrictive regulations in the entire state, including creating a system of system development charges that they placed on EFU land that was unprecedented. And in the process, they made it very difficult to obtain licenses within the county itself. Meanwhile, the city of Bend was very cooperative with the industry and fully allows licenses. The county did not. Now, let me explain a little bit about Deschutes County. It is an ideal climate for growing any crop inside a greenhouse. It has been suited to grow cannabis in greenhouses and inside at a very cost-effective rate compared to the rest of the United States, frankly. We have a unique microclimate here that allows production to occur at a less costly rate and without creating a large footprint on the environment. And that is why myself and others actually came to Bend. And then we fought the county for the last 8 years for the right to be able to grow a farm crop on EFU land. And the history of how we got here is pretty interesting, because what happened was, even though you guys passed a bill that said the county can't impose system development charges, they still are on EFU land. And basically, the county thought that the state was not giving them enough leeway to control cannabis the way they thought it should have been. And even though they were told by the legislature to actually loosen some of their regulations, they turned around and tightened their regulations. In response to that, an association here, a local cannabis association, challenged those regulations to LUBA. In response, the county decided to reconsider their new ordinances. And when they determined that the LUBA case was going to continue, if they continued to impose restrictive ordinances, they decided to opt out and have the matter put before the people for a vote last year. And even though when they opted out, they were told that the plain language of the statute would preclude them from tax revenues once they opted out, They scoffed at the tax revenues created by marijuana businesses at the time. There's even quotes in the paper of the Bed Bulletin of them scoffing at our tax revenues, saying, ah, these are insignificant compared to our whole budget. So at the time when they opted out, they really weren't concerned with these tax revenues. Now we have a new bill that's going to allow them to take 20% of the tax revenues that Bend businesses are creating, because Bend has a number. Bend has 30 retail licenses. The county has 16 production licenses in the county. Deschutes County would be one of the highest production counties if the county had been so restrictive. And now they've opted out, but now they want their cake and they want to eat it too. They want to say, hey, we want to prevent these businesses from expanding because here's where we're at in the world. Within 5 years, we're going to have interstate commerce and Oregon will take its place as a export positive cannabis producer, but not if we're not allowed to expand. And if you pass this bill, other counties will look at this and say, oh, we can opt out too, get tax revenues, and we're probably going to have this problem in some other counties that are large producers and will be helpful when Oregon takes its place in the interstate market within 5 years when federal laws are changed. And so I'm asking you folks to tell the county of Deschutes, which is also trying to, you know, they've also tried to say, hey, we don't have any good farmland here, so we want to make it easier to put developments on it. At the same time, they denied people rights to get cannabis licenses and made it extremely difficult, if not impossible now, but impossible even leading up to the opt-out. In the process, they've increased prosecutions of cannabis cases, and raids are taking place now weekly in Deschutes County. And they want to still take advantage of the tax benefits, even though they basically become a prohibition county again. And I'm urging you to tell the county if they want these tax benefits, then they can put this before the people again. Even some of the current commissioners admit that the language on the ballot was confusing and they don't understand how we had a blue sweep in the county, but somehow a cannabis measure lost. And so if they really want these tax revenues, then they can put it back on the ballot, and if it passes, they can get the tax revenues. And if it doesn't, then they knew the consequences going in. They were told by me and others that the statute was clear that they'd lose their tax revenues, and they chose to opt out because they really are, at least at that time, the county commissioners at that time were very opposed to cannabis. And that's changed a little bit now, so it'll be interesting to see what the commissioners do, but I'm asking the legislature to not pass this bill and give the county a special exception where they can, they're the only county that opted in and then opted out and created this problem. If they want to uncreate this problem, they can do it. They can present it to the voters in a clear way. And if the voters pass it, then they can get their tax revenues back. Thank you for your time and consideration and all the work you do in the cannabis and hemp world on this committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Okay, I see no questions. Our last witness is Rob Bovet.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rob Bovet, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. We don't have a formal position on this, but in speaking with Representative Krupp, I thought it might be a good idea for me to come on and just talk about the history here. But, and I realize in looking at Chair Burdick, you lived the history. You kind of were the history of this issue. You may recall that Measure 91 actually had a completely different tax structure for other reasons I won't get into, and we had to repeal all that and replace it in House Bill 3400 in 2015. And Chair Burdick, as co-chair of the Joint Marijuana Committee, you know, directed us to craft up the current statutes, which have been referred to here, the retail tax and the local option tax, and the opt-in, opt-out for the desired policy purposes that have already been explained. I don't think we anticipated the circumstance that Representative of Krupp has just described here out of Deschutes County. Deschutes has all kinds of challenges that both prior witnesses have explained. You may be aware that the entire state of Oregon put a moratorium on production, on new production, because we had too much production going on as well. But skipping all past that, I think the core issue here is Deschutes County still has quite a number of marijuana producers, as well as businesses and all the other categories, and denying them access to the funds to regulate these doesn't make sense as a practical matter. Further, it seems like if you just kill this bill, then we're just going to continue to send a message to Deschutes County that you should never have opted out, you should never have done this, but deny them the ability to actually work with the industry and the funds and the resources to do so. And then, of course, the bill's been amended to provide for an advisory committee, which we have in two of our largest producing counties, Josephine and Jackson, as has already been mentioned, that work quite well, that advise the Board of Commissioners. So, we don't have a formal position, but it kind of just makes practical sense that if Deschutes County is going to get a proportionate share of the dollars that they used to get, which is what we're really talking about, to regulate the existing businesses in Deschutes County, and we're also going to require them through this legislation to have an advisory committee to advise them to hopefully prevent some of the issues. And that's proven incredibly valuable in those high production counties where there are so many, quite frankly, neighbor to neighbor conflicts and zoning conflicts. So again, we don't have a position, but it just seems, just out of fairness and equity, that we ought to change this switch, this on and off switch, to something that looks more like a potentiometer. You can dial it up and dial it down depending upon what the county allows for. So Deschutes County won't be getting as much as they used to because they're not allowing new licenses. They're not allowing new licenses in production, although they are allowing new licenses in the other categories. So I just wanted to appear here today just to reference that history real briefly and let you know that I think you ought to look at this in terms of a moving forward basis, not necessarily punishment, because we do have a whole new approach toward cannabis in this particular county and as well as in the state. So I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, and I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? Okay, I see no questions and I see no more witnesses, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3295, and we will hold off on scheduling a work session. So our next public hearing will be House Bill 2434. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2434.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's me again. House Bill 2434, comes to you primarily now with to remove the sunset on the increase on jet fuel from 1 to 3 cents, and the aviation gasoline or avgas from 9 to 11. Those sunsets were put in effect when the increase was put in effect, and that was in the 2015 legislative session with House Bill 2075. So it requires that the sunset would have occurred, or would to be to occur in January 1st, 2022. This bill allows for the sunset to be removed and the tax to continue at this level, basically the tax increase on from that point on permanently. The also the bill changes slightly the way these new revenues coming from the taxes, that they are distributed to the different programs within the jurisdictions of the Department of Aviation. Changes some of that from 50% to 70% in what's called the CORE, or the Critical Oregon Airport Relief Program, and takes out the rural funding for commercial for commercial flights, and folds that program back into the CORE. So it becomes a 75-25 distribution rather than 50-25-25. Now, you also have with this bill an amendment, the dash A5 amendment. And the dash A5 amendment deals with another issue, which is the privilege tax or the timber taxes on forest product harvest. And what this amendment does is establishes the forest product harvest tax is a tax that needs to be extended every couple of years to set with a budget process. The tax itself, as you would see in your background, the bottom of the background material, currently is at $4 and 0.1322 for a million board feet. And it's constituted of five different rates that are put together to come up with this total rate. Now the A5 or the dash A5 amendment to this bill, of course, keeps the first tax with aviation and brings new changes to the different rates that you have for the five different rates that we've talked about as the components of the forest product harvest tax. The new amalgamated rate, or the resultant rate of all of that, is 4.99. And that's, of course, some one couple, a part of the rate is up to, which means this is the maximum or up to the rate that would be. So we also have for you in your meeting material, revenue impact statement for this bill as amended by the A5 amendment. So you have two sections of the revenue impact, primarily the aviation fuel tax sunset extension, and then the forest product harvest tax. And that part is basically it is the difference between what is continuing and what needs to be changed with the bill. So that's where those numbers are. Of course, any more detailed questions we have with us, Jamie, who would be able to answer other details on those changes. So that's what we have for you on this bill and that dash A5 amendment.
Okay, thank you. And just for a little context for the committee, the dash A5 amendment, as you've discovered, doesn't have anything to do with aviation tax. However, it is a tax measure that is the product of some high-level negotiations involving the Senate, the House, and the governor's office. And so we have been asked to perform the service of making that negotiation become reality, and we are here to serve. So, Senator Boquist, do you have excuse me, I'm ahead of myself.
We're still in a public hearing.
Yes, we're still in a public hearing, and I'm trying to hold on here. I don't believe we have, oh yes, we do, okay. All right, I will call Jake Jacobs as our first witness.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, and members of the committee. My name is Jake Jacobs. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Aviation Industries. We're a nonprofit association of aviation-related businesses in Oregon, and we focus on economic development, positive aviation legislation, and statewide air mobility. We're also Oregon Business Council's cluster group representing aviation for the state. We are in favor of House Bill 2434A because it eliminates the sunset and allows our current level of aviation funding to continue. And also the text has been changed from the original bill passed in 2015. So it provides a more equitable funding structure, especially for rural airports. It's not a general tax. It's paid for by the users of aviation. And like a road vehicle tax, it supports the infrastructure. Much lower than the road tax. It's only 3 cents a gallon for turbine and jet fuel and 11 cents a gallon for avgas used by piston aircraft. It provides for the ongoing funding of all of our airports, public airports in Oregon, 97 of them. And half of those receive federal grant matches. So the FAA can fund 90% if we put up 10% of the local funding. And that makes it pretty attractive because this bill covers aviation maintenance, safety, emergency preparedness. However, the previous bill had priorities established so that the 1090 FAA match was the number one priority, and nearly all the money, not all, but the great majority of it, went to fund half of our airports in Oregon, leaving many of the airports, including rural ones, without the ability to get funding. This bill's text fixes that. It also provides for us to pursue the potential opportunity for statewide air mobility using right-sized aircraft. What I mean by that are 4 to 8 place aircraft, not United and Delta. You should be able to go onto your cell phone in the next 3 or 4 years, ask for a flight, say from Aurora to Christmas Valley or Brookings to Ontario, and go out to your local airport, get on an FAA-approved commercial operator's aircraft, and fly for a reasonable amount of money. So we can't use the money in this bill to subsidize tickets, but we can at least start looking at a structure to make it happen with the new electric and hybrid aircraft that are coming on stream. This is a real possibility. This bill was supported by the Joint Transportation Committee, which transferred over to the House Revenue Committee with a unanimous vote. The House voted 53 in favor with only 6 opposed. And I might mention that when we first put the bill forward, 2 of our strongest supporters were rural people, Senator Ted Farrioli and Cliff Bentz, representative at the time. So this supports all of our airports statewide, especially in rural communities, and Oregon Aviation encourages a yes vote on House Bill 2434 to keep our aviation system functioning properly in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. And Senator Boquist, I believe you have a question for Mazin.
Yes, ma'am. I do have a question for Mazin.
Okay, please give your question.
Yeah, thank you. Mazin, both of us have been around forever, and so we both forgot more things than we can remember. But I was just told, in looking at the A5, after they resuscitated me on the 40% increase that is in the Section 3 of the A5 amendment, and that's the section that raises the percentage to support Oregon Forest Practices Act from $1.38 to $2.07. But then I was reminded by a former member of the Revenue Committee, who is now a county commissioner, that we used to pay that, and we'd gone back and forth over the last couple of years. So while the A5 looks like it is a significant increase year to year, is it correct that it's actually not as significant as increased historically?
Senator Boquist, I think you're correct. However, I'm gonna call on Jamie to actually, she probably have this more historical precise when these changed, and she would be able to answer that. So Jamie, she's in the room, I believe.
Senator Boquist, this is Jamie McGovern. So yeah, the funding and the rate for the Forest Practices Act has changed or moved around. I don't have our basic facts pulled up, but we do have that in our basic facts, and I can get that. But part of that has to do with budgets and ending year balances. So it can depend on several factors, also including the forecasted harvest, which I think has changed a little bit this year. So that can be a component of that as well. And in terms of the specific historical changes, I can get that to you in terms of a trend or just the recent years, but it has moved.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Please follow up.
If you could get that for the members of the committee, I would appreciate that, because I see in the statutory basis that the actual percentage of shares for example, the 40% share, that has not changed. It's just that the number appears to be moving back and forth based on what you were just said. And I believe we should get that placed in the record before some of us vote for a 40% tax increase. Thank you.
So I think, Chair Burdick, I can also get that by the end of the meeting.
That would be very helpful. Thank you. Senator Riley, because we have basically two bills here, it's unclear. And so please bear with us, Mr. Jacobs. Senator Riley, is your question for Mr. Jacobs?
It is. So, Mr. Jacobs, the base bill is about avgas tax and its usage in prop or turboprop or jet planes. How close are we to being able to use non-lighted gas in all of our prop planes in the state?
We probably won't see unleaded gas for quite a while with our existing aircraft. What's changing, what's dynamically changing the aviation industry is hybrid and electric aircraft, which are currently under certification by the CAA. You'll probably see in the next couple, 3 years, small electric aircraft replacing the piston aircraft that are out there today. And this is gonna greatly reduce the carbon footprint. So that's the solution in the fairly short term and in the long term.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up, please.
The electric and hybrid planes replacing the small prop planes, but that's not going to happen for a while. We're going to have these small prop planes around for a long time, using lighted gas. Is that your take on this?
Well, there are currently investigations underway to improve the type of gas a small aircraft use. Right. And this has been progressing fairly slowly. It's been ramping up more lately. And so we see that coming downstream. And between today and when electric aircraft are in the air, I think you're gonna see a more efficient fuel, which will produce less pollution in the air. So we are working on it and we're all in favor of it.
I understand. That was basically my first question, was what your take on how long you think that's going to take?
I think it's going to be at least the next 3 to 5 years before we see a substantial difference in the type of fuel small aircraft are using.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions of Mr. Jacobs? Okay. Yes?
This is Jamie. Hi, thank you. Would you like me to respond to Senator Boquist's question now?
Oh, that was quick. Yes, please do.
Okay, so I'll just say in terms of the movement for the funding for the Forest Practices Act, in terms of the rate, so the most recent high rate was in 2017 to 2018. It was $1.57. And then it dropped down 2019 to $1.37 and $1.39. Prior to 2017, it was slightly below a dollar for a few years. And then before that, it was up to $1.30. So it just, it does move around. In recent history, I don't see it I think the highest I see it is $1.57 in 2017 and 2018.
Okay. Senator Boquist, did you have a follow-up on that?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I just want Jamie to confirm this. The reason we see the jumping of the rate and the reason we see the $2 and whatever it is here, I'm looking again, $2.07 rate that's proposed now is based on what I believe you said earlier. The harvest last year was farther down, and it statutorily is a 60-40 split. In order for the landowners and the sellers of the timber to make those percentages, we have to raise the percentage to $2.07. But we are in fact maintaining the 60-40 split. Is that not correct?
Yeah, that remains in statute under this version of the bill.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Finley.
Thank you. And Senator Boquist asked most of my question, but I just want to assure or hear from Ms. McGovern that this is the exact same formulas and the same that was struck several years ago that established the timber tax, and you applied it based on harvest and the 60-40, and nothing has changed. This is other than the harvest from last year but nothing else has changed. This is just reflecting current conditions from the old agreed upon formula. So nothing new is interjected into this or changing.
So Senator Finley and Chair Burdick, so the structure, I think, is what you're referring to, the $10 million cap and the 40%, 60% split for the various components, those remain intact. Currently, we have for the Forest Land Protection Fund, 62.5% or 62.5 cents, that is increasing to 69 cents. And so the rates are changing, but the structure remains the same. In terms of this amendment as well, in that estimate that you see, the assumption is that the rate structure that comes out of OFRI would also remain the same.
So thank you. And just to follow up, Madam Chair.
Please do.
So what I heard you say, what I think I heard you say is what I think we've all been saying is that the structure of the agreement that was struck multiple years ago required and allowed every 2 years, every long session, this analysis take place and these new rates to be established based on an agreed upon structure. And this year it seems to have gone up a lot, but it's because of that agreed upon structure. And it's being based on harvest from the past. So there's not a new whiz bang going into this. This is the formula that was agreed. And hopefully if we have a higher cut year, it'll go down significantly the next long session when we do this same thing. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I see no more questions. For people who are not testifying, if you could turn your cameras off, that would be great. Our next witness is Betty Stansbury from the Oregon Department of Aviation.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Betty Stansbury, Director of the Oregon Department of Aviation. I will be very brief. So 2434 is the elimination of the sunset on the aviation fuel tax. The revenue from this fuel tax is used, almost all of it is used to fund a grant program that sends the money back out to Oregon's public use airports. It helps them with their local match on federal funds, with resiliency projects, with economic development projects. It has funded 132 projects at airports all across Oregon. Last week, your colleagues in the House voted overwhelmingly to save this program and allow it to continue. 53 voted in favor, and we're hoping that we will see the same strong support on the Senate side. So we would encourage and hope that you will think this program is worth saving, and you will send this to the floor with the dash four amendment. And then I would like to just briefly follow on to Senator Riley's question on 100 low lead. 97% of the aviation fuel sold in Oregon is jet fuel that does not contain lead in it. Only 3% is the 100 low lead that still contains lead in it. So again, the majority of fuel sold in Oregon does not contain lead in it. So, and that's all I had. Thank you.
Thank you. And just to clear the record, I believe the Dash 4 amendment went into it in the House. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay, Senator Finley.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Director, it's my understanding, and I have, is that the agreements that we had months ago now, it seems like years ago, concerning the Corridor and SOAR programs or the grant award programs, you were going to retool those and more reflective, that is reflected in this program, isn't it? Is it not?
Yes, Senator Finley, it is.
And Madam Director, I appreciate your working on that, and I think it will certainly put this in a much better position. So thanks for your great work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? I see no questions, so thank you. And our last witness is JL Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, this is JL Wilson representing the Oregon Airport Management Association, and I'm just quickly going to say we support the bill. This has been a consensus bill for over 2 years now. It's gotten caught up in some politics along the way, but the reality is there's no known opposition to this. We came to agreement on the sunset removal and changing the configuration of the programs, and we've just been waiting for opportunity to get it passed. So we do support this wholeheartedly and ask that you also approve it. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for JL? See no questions. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2434 and open a work session on House Bill 2434A. Senator Boquist.
Madam Chair, I move the A5 amendment to House Bill 2434, dated 6/18/21, into the main bill.
Senator Boquist has moved the dash A5 amendment to House Bill 2434A. Is there any discussion? Okay, would you please call the roll?
Senator Finley.
Senator Finley votes aye.
Senator Riley.
Riley votes aye.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner votes aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist votes aye.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Burdick votes aye. The amendment passes. Senator Boquist.
Yes, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 2434 as amended by the A5 to the floor with a due pass, and I'm not carrying it.
Oh, you anticipated me. Senator Boquist has moved House Bill 2434A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, please call the roll.
Senator Finley.
Senator Finley votes aye, and I agree with Senator Boquist.
Senator Riley.
Votes aye.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner votes aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Yep, Senator Boquist is voting yes.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Burdick votes aye. And since I lost my, two of my carriers, I guess that leaves me to carry this bill. Okay, close the work session on House Bill 2434 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2438.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Jamie McGovern, Legislative Revenue. House Bill 2438A establishes a permissive property tax exemption program for workforce housing. So in counties that have populations of less than 15,000, then the governing bodies would be able to set up ordinance which would allow a property tax exemption for homes if the homeowner is has income less than $75,000 or joint filers with less than $150,000. And then it establishes some sideboards around the program that could potentially be adopted. It's a permissive property tax exemption program.
Okay, we have nobody signed up for this. Am I looking at this correctly? I believe we have nobody signed up, but I think Senator Finley had some comments about that. Am I making that up, Senator Finley? You're on mute.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. So the hour is late, and we don't need to belabor this anymore. I think it's a great bill, and it should pass.
Okay. I like those brief comments. Is there any other discussion of this bill? Okay. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2438 and open a work session on House Bill 2438.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 2438A to the floor with a do pass, and Senator Finley knows the most about it.
Okay, Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2438 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, please call the roll.
Senator Finley.
Senator Finley votes yes, and yes, I will, Madam Chair.
Senator Riley.
Votes aye.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner votes aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist votes aye.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Burdick votes aye. I feel like I'm being directed on this carry thing here. So I will comply with that and assign it to by far the best carrier for this bill, Senator Finley. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2456.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. Yeah, House Bill 2456, this is an omnibus measure that's predominantly going to be technical changes. I would steer you away from the SMS, and rather in the meeting materials, you'll see a section contents of the bill that goes through each of the sections to hit on the points or the changes being made in the bill. And I'll just walk through that really briefly, Madam Chair, as I know the committee has a stacked agenda today. But so the section contents, the very first section is an update to ABLE accounts. This is just a point in time connection that we missed in the annual reconnect bill. Sections 2 through 6 relate to two property tax exemptions and making changes, and I believe you'll have testimony on this, adjusting to some of the federal changes and some definitional changes, so truing those two up. The next change in Section 7 and 8, again, relate to another property tax exemption, in this case, the environmental sensitive logging equipment, and adjusting a definition for held for use that helps individuals that are qualifying for this exemption or that have this property or are not qualifying but have this property to continue qualifying, even if the property, the environmental sensitive logging equipment, is not used during the year. We then get to sections 9 and 12, which is a property tax exemption predominantly used by the city of Portland. So hear some testimony on that about giving them an extra 12 months on the construction of this single unit housing for this property tax exemption. You then get into sections 13 and 14, which relate to two auction tax credits Oregon has, the film and video auction tax credit and the opportunity grant auction tax credit. And it's just a change in the timing and when these auctions can occur. To allow an auction to occur closer to the tax return filing deadline, with the idea being it could encourage purchases of these credits at auction because it shortens the time of when the credit is purchased and when it's used on the return. Moving down, we have a corporate excise tax change in Section 16. That's just changing an adjustment or a connection to the Internal Revenue Code. There was a change made at the federal level, so Oregon's just having to point to the correct spot in the IRC, the Internal Revenue Code. Reflective of those federal changes. Section 17 is related to the vehicle privilege tax, which is allowing Department of Revenue to share information with DMV about the vehicle privilege tax. So administrative and enforcement there. We then move to Section 18 to 20, which City of Portland background checks. You'll have testimony, I believe, from City of Portland on this, on helping them with their administration of their tax system. And then Section 21 through 24, this is related to manufactured dwelling park capital gain and an income tax subtraction that exists today under current law. This is an adjustment to that existing income tax subtraction, allowing a park that has been destroyed by a natural disaster. So the testimony here related to wildfires, but if a park was destroyed in a natural disaster and the park owner then sells that park to a nonprofit or a housing authority, they can then get a capital gain subtraction for that capital gain income. So create an incentive to sell those parks to a nonprofit or a housing authority. And then Section 25 through 28 relates to the Shortland Railroad credit, and that's just making some statutory cleanup language, really. So eliminating some redundant statute and correcting some cross-references. But again, a lot in this bill, a lot of it is technical changes being made, Madam Chair, and you do have information in OLIS in the meeting materials that goes through each of the changes.
Thank you. Our infamous cleanup bill here in front of us. We have Eric Knoll from the City of Portland signed up.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, and members of the committee. For the record, Eric Knoll with the City of Portland. I'll be very brief just to highlight our support of two sections of this bill. First, sections 9 through 12, the single unit housing tax exemption fix, and sections 18 through 20, which would authorize our revenue division to request background checks from the Oregon State Police to conform with IRS guidelines. Given the time of day and that this is an omnibus bill, I will just make myself available to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? I see no questions. So we'll call on Lauren Naldoza from the Oregon Housing Alliance.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lauren Naldoza for the record. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance to express our support for, again, two parts of HB 2456. I won't belabor what Eric had mentioned, but just to extend our support for sections 9 through 12 of the bill, that's the homeownership limited tax exemption or HOLTE technical fix. But I just wanted to spend maybe a little bit more time on sections 2 through 6, which expands to local option affordable housing property tax exemptions. So the legislature has authorized several property tax exemptions in the past for affordable housing. Local option property tax exemptions are one tool local jurisdictions can use to help incentivize and make financially viable affordable housing developments in their communities. And these tax exemptions are extremely important to affordable housing in communities across the state. They provide an ongoing financial support to these developments. And without them, local affordable housing developers would need additional resources to serve the lowest income members of their communities. And in 2017, the federal government made a few critical changes that allows for more people of different income levels to be served by the same affordable housing development. And this policy impacts the federal LIHTC, or Low Income Housing Tax Credit, which is one of the main tools to develop affordable housing in our communities. And this new policy is called income averaging. It allows developments to serve people with slightly higher incomes, around 80% of area median income, if the property also serves people with lower incomes, and that the average income of the property remains at 60% of the average of the area median income. And we think this change is important. It aligns flexibility and rules with federal guidelines, and it prevents a patchwork of different restrictions. And I will stop there just to say we urge you to support the bill as is, HB 2456, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? I see no questions. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2456A and open a work session on House Bill 2456A. Senator Boquist.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2456A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist has moved House Bill 2456A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion?
Yes, ma'am. It's a perfect bill for me to carry.
There you go, pushing me around again. Okay, please take the roll.
Senator Finley.
Senator Finley votes aye.
Senator Riley.
Riley votes aye.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner votes aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist votes aye.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Burdick votes aye. And with gratitude, I will ask Senator Boquist to carry this. Okay. Now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2634.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2634A deals with the Senior and Disabled Citizens Property Tax Deferral Program. It's not a property tax exemption, so there wouldn't be a revenue impact because the local jurisdictions still get their funding. It's just that the Department of Revenue has a dedicated fund, and the program pays the property taxes on behalf of those participants in the program, and then the money gets repaid when either the participants die or they sell their home or essentially they just decide to leave the program. There's an extension of the sunset for this program, and then there's a few tweaks to the program itself. There's a minimum maximum allowable real market value for the property, so modest homes, so to speak, are included. And this just sets a minimum threshold for that at $250,000. That affects rural counties. And it also adjusts allowable income for the participants in the household to the CPI, and then does there's a interest sharing component between the Department of Revenue and the counties if a property is foreclosed on, and a few other changes like that. The sort of portion that deals with the disabled participants is that if somebody were to be in the program and then they have a disabled heir, there's a requirement in the program that you must be living in your property or your home for 5 years. This would allow that person, the heir, to continue in the program, for instance, if their parent died and then they weren't officially registered as the owner of the home. So waiving that 5-year requirement for the participants. And I'm here for questions.
Okay, we have Seiji Shiratori from the Oregon Department of Revenue.
All right, thank you, Chair Burdick, committee members, Seiji Shiratori, Oregon Department of Revenue, Property Tax Division. Just real happy to testify in support of House Bill 2634, which would continue this vital program that helps over 5,000 Oregonians, seniors, and disabled citizens remain in their homes. And extending the sunset would give some program predictability for us administering it at the department, as well as the county assessors and the tax districts. And these several small but important refinements to the program that Jamie was describing, I just wanted to assure you that we have anticipated all of them. We've spoken with stakeholders about the various refinements, and we're ready to implement them. So I urge an aye vote, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, thank you for your work on this program. Some of us go back to the alarming days. I think it was in 2009 where the program actually ran out of money. And so I really appreciate the care you've taken to make sure that you're thoroughly analyzing these changes. They're good changes. Okay. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2634 and open a work session on House Bill 2634. Senator Boquist.
Yes, ma'am. I move House Bill 2634A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist has moved House Bill 2634A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? I see no discussion, so please take the roll.
Senator Finley.
Senator Finley votes aye.
Senator Riley.
Votes aye.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner votes aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist votes aye.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Burdick votes aye. And Senator Riley, you have escaped carrying responsibility, so we'll put this one on you today.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you, committee. This completes our agenda. Chris, do we have any other business that we have to deal with?
No, Madam Chair, you've completed your agenda. I can see path forwards for where there is or is not another committee meeting.
Right. We will not have a committee meeting tomorrow, although that's the last information I have. So that information could change, but right now we're not planning a meeting tomorrow. So if we do have another meeting, it will be Wednesday. So, but we have nothing scheduled. And I think we don't have that much in the pipeline. So this could be it, but not necessarily. So thank you very much. And we are adjourned.